This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. DC 37 is New York City's largest public employee union. We are part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast on Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We're also available as a podcast. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone or tablet and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There's now more ways to stay in touch with us. You can always check out our website, www.dc37.net. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. If you have any comments about our show or would like us to promote a community event, please drop us a line at State of the Union, that's one word, at dc37.net. State of the Union at dc37.net. We begin tonight's show by welcoming Erica Boll, who is in the studio with us. She is the executive director of the David Prize. I'm going to say good evening. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm wondering what the David Prize is. It sounds great, but tell us about it.
So the David Prize is a new initiative that aims to fund and help celebrate individuals that uniquely impact New York City. And that could be socially, environmentally, economically. It's an investment in individuals in New York City, any New Yorker, that is making the city better off for more of us.
And this is something that just happened. I mean, I've been seeing things. I've been seeing signs. The word is getting out there, and this is part of that effort. But this was a new idea. How did the idea come from?
Yeah. So it just launched September 3rd, 2019. So we're about a month in. We're actively trying to get the word out, and we're doing that digitally. So hopefully we're showing up on your Instagram and Twitter and Facebook accounts. We're also doing that physically through the subways, through billboards, through flyers, through community partners, through churches and schools. And the idea initially came from the Walentis family, which is the foundation behind this prize. They have been a long supporter of individuals in the city through philanthropic work for many, many years. And so this initiative is an attempt to broaden that program and really broaden their reach in terms of the types of folks that represent New York City and help support and invest in those individuals to further their work.
So when you say this is open to any New Yorker who has a big idea, who's been working on something and needs funding for it, I'm kind of wondering how you get to be doing something interesting unless you have been supported by something, and how this helps move that along. Or are you looking for somebody who walks in and says, I can make New York a happier place and I can prove it, and I need $200,000 to help make that happen? What are you hoping to accomplish at the end of this?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I'll start off with the criteria just to help give shape to the who it is that this prize aims to support and celebrate. So a couple of things. One is we're looking for individuals that are exclusively focused on New York City at the time of applying for the prize. So what that means is they live in the five boroughs and their work is specific to the five boroughs. So it's solving questions, theses, tensions, fights that are relevant in New York City today that we all experience, that we see, that we're impacted by. So that's the first. The second is we're looking for folks with a really bold vision for the city and who have specific activities or ways to push that vision forward. So it's not enough just to have an idea of how might we make the city better. It's both a bold vision and specific activities to push that vision forward. So we've heard from folks who have ideas on paper. We've heard from folks who have side hustles, who have been doing this as part of their weekend work, their passion project, their pet project. We've also heard from folks who are fully invested in a thing. It's their full-time effort, and they are trying to take this off the ground. They could be 25. We've met with young people. We've also met with folks who are retired and are doing this as kind of their second wind or career, if you will. So that's the second criteria, is this really bold vision for the city and specific ways to make that happen and articulation of that. The third is the person is the right person to do the thing. And again, for a 25-year-old, they don't have decades of work experience, but they have a lot of personal experiences that could make them the best person to think about homelessness in New York City, if that's the experience in which they grew up in. So as one example, we've also met with folks who have been teaching in the public school systems for years and have a lot of ideas around how to think about after school mentorship or learning. And that also is part of the kind of composition of one's story that we're looking for. How does professionally and personally their story make them the best person to move that thing forward? And the last piece is, to your question, a real need for the prize. The funding itself is unrestricted. So it is, we'll never ask how it's spent. It's intended to free up the financial space for someone to do their work in a more concerted way. The mental, emotional, and financial bandwidth. And so to that end, we have heard folks who have great ideas who can't do that work because of childcare, because they're taking care of their parents, because of prohibitive rent costs, because they can't get a studio. We've also heard from folks who have ideas underway but need support to be able to scale that up in some way. They need to hire someone. They need to get insurance to operate. They need to. And so this is really intended to take individuals with amazing, bold visions for New York City that might be quite risky. They might not be proven out, and double down on their work and them as a person.
When you say bold vision, are you talking about folks who, I mean, I'm sure that there are very meaningful projects and very meaningful work that does not try to change the life of the entire city, but is finding a small piece of the city and making it better in some way. So you're not suggesting that the person has to be. I'm sure that there are DC 37 members out there who every day are doing something, have ideas about things, but it's not going to be something that's going to change the entire face of the city. It's something that's going to improve some part of the city, perhaps.
Yeah.
That is as eligible. So I just want to make sure we got
that's
it right.
Because
the bold vision thing sort of intimidates me as somebody who says, well, I love bold visions, but that's a big thing.
Yeah.
This prize is also willing to recognize small scope, perhaps, even if the vision is bold.
Yeah. So, and that's why this piece around having a vision and specific ways to move it forward is really important. We've met folks who are doing amazing work, who work with 40 students a year. And they impact them really deeply. We've met folks who are informal mayors of their buildings or city blocks, who are bringing knowledge and services and food in places that otherwise might be called a food desert. So the scale of the idea and the specific activities at the time of applying is important, but we're considering folks who are impacting 40 lives just as much as someone who has the vision to impact all five boroughs and all 8 million of us.
We're talking about the David Prize, which was recently announced. It's a new $1 million award program. It's five innovators will get $200,000 each. There is a deadline for this, so why don't you tell us, and why don't you tell us the process, okay, if there is a listener out there who should be a recipient of the David Prize, what does that person do next?
Yeah. So our website, www.thedavidprize.org, has a link to apply. And so you can start the process by sharing your vision for New York City with us through the link. There's an apply button, which you'll see. We're also encouraging folks to nominate people that they know who are doing amazing work,
right,
who otherwise might not think this is for them. They might be too close to the work to know that it's amazing. And so if listeners know a family member, a teacher, a principal, a health worker, a nurse that supported them, that is doing amazing work and has the potential to do a lot more, we're asking folks to nominate, which can also be found on our website. The process is a quick form online. We'll be in touch with next steps if folks are eligible, and that's all shared on the website as well. The final step is a conversation with our team and with our advisors, who are all representative of folks that are 10 years too late for the prize. And so I encourage folks to look at those advisors and their work and their stories to really understand more about the who.
How did you find those folks? Because I glanced at some of the advisors, and they are interesting people. I mean, how did those connections get made?
They're amazing. And we were really lucky to have them on board to help shape the thinking and the strategy of this prize, because their stories and their work represent what this prize aims to celebrate. So we did a lot of research. We've been talking to a lot of folks who are movers and shakers across the city to try to figure out the who and where the funding gaps are, we know individuals have amazing potential, and we think this advisor group really demonstrates what that could look like, what the opportunity and potential is. We also thought, because it's year one, it's really helpful to have examples of what these people look like. And they're across sectors, they're across geographies, they work in different parts of the city, they work with different types of people. Some are for-profit, some are nonprofit. And so that's really kind of the spirit that we're trying to embody with this prize, and really hope to celebrate. But folks that need a kind of a capital injection, some funding to further that work and vision.
It's the David Prize. It's, again, the website is the David Prize. It's very, that was very clever.
Turns out, trying to make it easy.
It's like people go, we have dc37.net, and people say, you know, I'm always looking for dc37.com, but 20 years ago we had dc37.net and we were living with it. So it's the David Prize.com.
.org. .org. Just to clarify, O-R-G, .org.
Okay, there you go. And when you get to, and when you get online, you're saying that it is not a cumbersome introduction. It is...
No.
Okay.
It's intended to be really easy. We also share our email in case there are questions. So you can always shoot us a note. If you do have questions or trouble signing in, it should be a pretty straightforward process. You can access it on a smartphone, on a computer, and we'll be in touch around next steps to kind of push you through the process from there.
Okay, let me just read this. Submissions to the David Prize will be accepted from September 3rd through December 1, 2019. Along with the online application, the submission process will include site visits, in-person interviews, referrals, and presentations. The five winners will be announced in spring 2020. The winners will receive $200,000 over a two-year period, $100,000 per year. And as you say, you are not like limiting, or you're not monitoring, or you're not, once you decide this is a good thing, you're just saying go.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's no restrictions on the funding. Yeah. So again, it's used to further that individual's work, and it's a bet on them as an individual with ideas, but it really is an investment in New Yorkers and folks that otherwise wouldn't have access to funding to do this work.
Erica Boll is the executive director of the David Prize. I want to thank you for coming into the studio and talking about the prize. Folks, you've got until December 1st, 2019. And that's just a couple months away. So thank you.
Thanks so much for the time.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
We're back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE. I'm Chris Policano, and our next guest is someone who's been on the show before. We talk fairly regularly about labor history. He is a labor historian. He is the author of Class War USA, Dispatches from Workers' Struggles in American History. His name is Brandon Weber. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
You're working on something about, you've been looking at impeachment, and this is a subject that I think that most folks claim to know much more than they know about the subject.
And it's interesting, isn't it, that, Chris, that in our lives have been the three of the four impeachments have been in our lifetimes. It's crazy. but it's real. That's been since Nixon. So,
but Nixon wasn't actually impeached, right? Nixon resigned before he got, but it was on the cusp of impeachment that was going to happen.
It was immediately before impeachment. I mean, and the process to actually get to impeachment is a little bit, there's a lot to it, but the simple version is in the House, they investigate, and the Senate decides whether or not to remove somebody from office. And that's what happened with Nixon. The House had it way enough to get Nixon out of there. And I can talk in a little bit about what the charges were. But when it went to the Senate, they would have voted for him to be out of there. And so he knew that. He knew that it's better for him in history to just leave. And that's what he did.
And you can't get impeached for being a bad president. I mean, bad decisions by themselves are not impeachable offenses, correct?
That's correct. What the official line is you can be impeached for treason, bribery, and other high crimes and misdemeanors, although high crimes and misdemeanors, quote unquote, that is not clear. It's sort of up to Congress/Senate to interpret what those high crimes and misdemeanors are. I mean, you know, in the case of Bill Clinton, it started off as an investigation into Whitewater, right? It was about their real estate dealings, him and Hillary. Well, and then it turned into sexual stuff between him and a consenting adult, and that was what it turned into. And I mean, Democrats these days saying, well, we don't want to impeach because, you know, it was bad politically for us. Like, no, it was only bad politically in the case of Clinton because it was silly things. It was not arranging to investigate a candidate for president in exchange for military support or lack thereof. It wasn't anything to that level. None of that. It was simply, you know, hey, consenting adults is what it was, basically. And then Bill Clinton's reaction to it, which was to try and lie about it, try to cover some of that up, because he knew, you know, hey, this stuff can go south.
Right.
But that's why I mean, Clinton's was actually not in the Senate, so the House voted to impeach based on, you know, lying to the grand jury, which he did.
Right.
We didn't have sexual relations and blah blah blah. The Senate voted to basically leave it alone, but boot it out. They voted 50 in favor of impeaching and 55 against. So there you go. You need a 2/3 majority to impeach.
Well, there are only,
you need a two. Yeah.
Well, hold on a second. There's only 100 guys in the Senate. So how did 100 people in the Senate?
It was a different time. That's all. I have to look into that further because the numbers seem a little weird on that one. Yeah.
Well, go back to Andrew Johnson, right? Because what did Andrew Johnson get impeached for?
Andrew Johnson, this was an interesting time in history, right? It was right after Abraham Lincoln was killed, and Johnson assumed presidency because of that. Now, remember that during that time, Reconstruction was definitely on the table, and that became the kind of the sticking point, the political sticking point, the what they called radical Republicans. And back then, remember that Republicans then were the other side politically than they are today.
Right.
So radical Republicans then were strongly in favor of Reconstruction in the South, including the right to vote for African American men, include the military basically being the governing body in the South that would decide things related to how African Americans could be integrated into the communities because they were former slaves and they didn't, you know, there was a lot to be done. And so instead of having governors and mayors and what have you, political parties down South who were all, you know, Confederate. So instead of having them make these decisions, the military was going to go down there and do this. So that was the radical Republican point of view. They had 2/3 majority House, 2/3 majority Senate, and they said this is what's going to happen. Johnson disagreed with that. He was going to be kinder to the former Confederates. And so what he did was, well, then the Senate and the House both passed a law that said you cannot make changes to the administration, including the Secretary of War and all that kind of thing, without our approval. Basically, they said you can't do anything you can't move without us approving it. And Johnson, you know, didn't like that.
Right.
And so that's called the Tenure of Office Act. And the Tenure of Office Act said they couldn't do that. Well, he did anyway. They took a break, as they did back then. They were in recess, and Johnson replaced Stanton, who was the Secretary of War then, and replaced him with actually General U.S. Grant. He thought it would be a popular, you know, Grant was the most popular individual then because he helped win the war. And so he replaced him with him, and Grant saw that it was going to be a nightmare and got out quickly, then replaced him with somebody else, Lorenzo Thomas. That was a violation of the act, and the articles of impeachment were drawn up within 3 days. There were 11 articles of impeachment drafted by the House, and they all were related to his actions around Stanton and removing him and the Tenure of Office Act. But this is notable in light of today's things happening. One of the things, the 11th charge, was an attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. Well, that was a big one because he'd actually toured the country making speeches, basically calling Congress a bunch of, you know, whatever phrases he used, but it was trying to bring Congress into contempt. Look at that compare. I mean, that's happening today with this president, right? That is exactly what's happening.
So this kind of thing. So this has been about, with Nixon, there were a series of things that the Nixon had done that that brought him to where he was, starting with Watergate.
Right.
But with Johnson and possibly Trump, it seems to be about checks and balances. Is that is that a fair description of this?
And I think that's a fair description. I mean, one of the, again, let's draw the parallels between that and today. I mean, Nixon, he arranged break-ins at the Democratic National Committee in the Watergate office complex. He arranged that with his people, and then they talked about it. They covered up all evidence they could, including the infamous Nixon tapes. He recorded almost every conversation he had in the White House.
And kept them. And kept them.
Yes, he kept them, and he would not turn them over. When Congress said, we need to hear those, he said, nope, not going to do it. You don't have a right to. And that actually ended up in the Supreme Court, who said, yep, Congress has a right to investigate. And so the three articles of impeachment that actually came through the House and went to the Senate before Nixon resigned were obstruction of justice. This is related to the Watergate break-ins and the attempt to cover up of all of that, including withholding the tapes. Then abuse of power related to violating the constitutional rights of citizens and impairing justice, which means what the shorter version of that is political espionage and illegal surveillance, especially related to Daniel Ellsberg, who was the main leaker of the Pentagon Papers at the time. So, you know, it's the same kind of thing. He tried to horse trade, trying to get dirt on Daniel Ellsberg, dig up dirt. So, the last one was contempt of Congress. This is notable. Failure to produce critical evidence and refusing subpoenas issued to him by Congress. So he said, not going to take the subpoena, not going to produce the evidence, not going to send any of my staff. What's happening just yesterday? What happened? Exactly the same thing, right?
So let me get this right. So Donald Trump is using the Richard Nixon playbook to deal with the impeachment.
Yes.
His possible.
Now, the only thing that I would say is that he's definitely got the Supreme Court on his side, where Nixon didn't necessarily have that. So it might be a different play. It might work out differently for the American people and for the world, for that matter, and for Trump. This is all some of the same things. You know, it's the same kind of stonewalling. We're not going to give you anything. We're not going to, you know. And in fact, Congress has the power to arrest and imprison the people like that in the Trump administration that have been refusing to cooperate, refusing to give evidence, refusing any documentation, put them in jail. Ted Lieu just said, just 2 days ago, he just said, why don't we use that power? Well, it hasn't been used since 1934. Why don't we use it? And I totally agree with that. The first time one of these people goes up into Congress and says, I'm not giving you anything, go to hell. And they take them off in handcuffs and put them in jail, the rest of them will squawk. They will all – they'll start to spill, definitely.
And recent international events, again, the question of whether or not we were having some conversation in the studio before we started talking about the Kurds and Turkey and what those acts or what he is doing or not doing in terms of supporting an ally – how that influences, I guess, more politically than actual process of impeachment. Mm-hmm. So as people say, this is a terrible decision, it doesn't necessarily affect the conversation about impeachment.
I think that's right. What it does is erode the support of number 45 in Congress, and especially in the Senate. It erodes the support when he takes stupid actions like that. And that's, you know, as we know, especially with Moscow Mitch, we know that...
Moscow Mitch, you're in the mood today.
we know that that the Senate has been basically, you know, okaying anything that this guy wants to do. And I think with that decision, that military decision, I think that's turning some heads and making people realize what an idiot he is, and what kind of actions he takes.
You mentioned the Supreme Court. I am not clear on what role the Supreme Court plays in this. So briefly, because we just have a couple minutes left, what role does the Supreme Court have in impeachment, if any?
So when it goes to the Senate, if the House says, yep, there's stuff here, and here's our articles of impeachment, here's a 3 or 5 or 6 or whatever, then it goes to the Senate, and that's adjudicated by, in this case, John Roberts, by the top dude in the Supreme Court. So that's what that is. He'll be the one hearing it and deciding on it. It may not matter. You need a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate to remove somebody from office. In Johnson's case, he almost got removed from office, but it failed by one vote in the Senate.
Gotcha.
If that were to happen in this case, if it came that close, then I believe Roberts would have the final vote. But he will also, you know, sort of manage the voting and all the things that are going to happen, all the theater that'll happen before the actual vote.
All right. We've been talking with labor historian and author Brandon Weber. Brandon, it's always great to have you on and to get smarter about things. The book that Brandon is the author of, which I think is a terrific book, it's Class War USA, Dispatches from Workers' Struggles in American History. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And that's just about all the time we have this evening. I want to just, before we go, a couple of announcements. Members continue to visit Union Headquarters at 125 Barclay for activities and services with staff members available to help meet your needs. The staff has moved to a temporary office on Water Street, but Barclay Street is open for members to come. We've set up service desks, and if you need any more information or if you need help, just call 212-815-1000. If you're having trouble erasing your federal student debt, get help by attending a workshop on Tuesday, October 29th at 5:30 p.m. at 125 Barclay Street. Register at www.dc37.net/student-debt. And the Ed Fund is holding workshops on resume writing, interview techniques, and test-taking strategies this month and in November. For details on registration, location, and time, visit www.dc37.net or call 212-815-1700. I want to thank our guests, the David Prize Executive Director, Erica Boll, and labor historian, Brandon Weber. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. If you have any comments about this show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Until next time, ciao.